We're talking with Brian Holland, a broadcaster, award-winning broadcaster and talk show host who became enthralled, I guess, at an early age with what we would call neo-Nazis, white supremacists, white separatists, white nationalists, and rose to become their presidential candidate. But he had a secret. He had a secret agenda that he was pursuing during these years, working with another organization. And when we come back, we're going to reveal that secret for the first time anywhere. Stay with us, everyone. This is Coast to Coast AM. Brian, we have reached the point in the show where it's time to spill the beans, so to speak. Go ahead and tell the audience what other agenda you were pursuing during these years that you were working with these organizations.
George, I feel like I'm playing I've Got a Secret. it's one of my favorite shows, by the way. I started in 1999, George, and I'll be glad to go into as much detail as you'd like anytime. Starting in 1999, I went to work for the FBI and the Justice Department as what began as basically just what they call a source, gathering information on these organizations. And shortly thereafter, got a little deeper and over the process of 11 years, George, and you're the, I'm a little nervous even saying this, but became what they consider an extremely deep cover intel source and operative for the Department of Justice.
You were a mole.
Basically, yes. Mole, rat, highly paid, however you want to say it. That was me.
Okay, so how were you recruited?
I had some legal problems don't you love when people say they had legal problems, in about 93, late 92, early 93. I actually served 2 years with the Department of Corrections in the state of Virginia.
For what? Tell us what you did.
Sure. I think I already shared with you, so I don't mind at all. I was the idiot who told someone how to properly conduct an armed robbery. In the state of Virginia, that makes you guilty of a conspiracy, and in the state of Virginia, if you're within 10 miles of a felony, you're being charged with that felony. I was charged with armed robbery and even charged with use of a firearm in the commission of a felony. And I'm not defending myself, I mean, this is court record, I've never handled a firearm in my life, but in Virginia, and I'm not complaining, I know what I did, in Virginia, you get the same charges as the other person you're with. Looking back on it, George, I agree completely. Thankfully, a very good attorney. I received a 7-year sentence with three suspended, I believe. And in Virginia, you serve half of your time on good behavior, which I had no problem doing. Long story short, overheard something one day while I was serving my time, called my attorney, said, hey, I don't want anything out of this, but somebody needs to know about it. There was a kid in jail with me bragging about beating someone to death with a cinder block, George. I have an issue with that because despite committing a crime, I like to consider myself a good person. Wouldn't beat anyone to death with a cinder block. I think that's probably a little out of my grasp. But I met a Norfolk, Virginia police detective who was in charge of criminal intelligence at the time. He took my statement. I ended up testifying in the kid's murder trial. He's now serving life in prison, where I hope he's met some very nice people. He beat someone to death with a cinder block because he thought the guy made a pass at him. Just a wee bit out of human spectrum for me there, George.
So you provided some information.
Yeah.
A guy got put away, and then so someone saw you as somebody who could be recruited.
This lieutenant, who by the time I saw him again had been promoted to captain, his name was Charlie. Charlie's retired now. Charlie called me in 1999. I was done with my sentence. I released in May of 95. I went right back to radio, by the way. I was done with my sentence, was done with my probation. Charlie said, I want you to come and have lunch with me and a friend. And, you know, when you've just served all that time on probation, George, when a police officer wants to have lunch, you go have lunch. You don't ask questions.
Right.
I went, plus I got a free meal. I went and met Charlie. He introduced me to a gentleman named Greg, who I learned was with the FBI. This was before 9/11, of course. There was no official domestic terrorism task force at the time, which there is now, but Greg's beat basically was these organizations. Greg made a pitch to me. We think with your radio background, the fact that you already know some of these people, and the fact that you've served 2 years in prison, which of course in the movement is like a Boy Scout badge, we think you're the guy we need. He told me what they wanted. I didn't know this went on, George. I thought this only went on in the movies. Jimmy Cagney movies and things with guys giving information, but he made the pitch, and I without batting an eye, said I can do this. Basically, what I started as, George, was I would go to meetings and as a journalist, basically write a report, and I would turn the same report into the FBI that I would have given on my radio show.
In fact, one of your first assignments was a radio show, right?
Yes. I'm glad you mentioned that. I forgot all about that. I used to use the radio show as a cover to go to these organizations, and until I got deep enough into the organizations where I was accepted as a part of what was going on. A guy named Matt Hale up in Peoria, Illinois, who's now serving, I think, a 40 to life sentence in federal prison for trying to hire someone to kill a federal judge. Matt was at the time, a pretty well-known white supremacist. He was the head of an organization named World Church of the Creator, who believed that white people were the only people entitled to live on Earth. They were a little different compared to what I was used to. Matt was really shocking. I had this image in my head of this monster that was trying to destroy everything that wasn't white. Pulled up to his house in a taxi cab in a nice suburban neighborhood. He answers the door, George, in a pair of blue jeans and an L.L. Bean flannel shirt. And I spent a week with him thinking, somebody's got to be wrong about this guy. I mean, we sat and had tea together. He didn't eat processed foods, nuts, berries, raw vegetables is all he ate. And I'm listening to him and watching him thinking, they've just got to be wrong. And when I got back and filed the report and learned everything else about him, I changed my opinion a little. But yeah, I early on used the radio show as cover, which was the perfect cover back then. And then I, whether fortunately or unfortunately, again, got sucked a little further into the movement, and the Department of Justice kept pushing me, go further, go further, go further.
And are you paid for this work?
Very well, George. I'm not ashamed to say, very well. It's my joke in my head was always, that's your tax dollars at work. That's what I always told myself.
How did they pay you?
They paid travel. I think I sent you samples of some of the things I did as far as what I would need to do to set up the travel with I call it the office with the bureau. I got to the point where I was basically picking my own assignments because I've been doing it so long. The joke around the Norfolk FBI office was that I had more seniority than most of the agents did. But I would decide where to go, get it cleared with my handler, which was the agent in charge of me. I would need to send in the details. If I were driving, how far is the round trip drive? How much do I estimate the gas would be? The hotel, the per diem. If I were flying, I'd have to include all that. Every foreseeable expense had to be in my request. I actually, if I drove, George, to answer your question, I got paid by the mile, plus I got X number of dollars per diem, plus the hotel was paid for. Any other expenses that were incurred on the trip, as long as I could justify it as an expense for the assignment, it was covered. If I purchased merchandise at the rallies, books, DVDs, T-shirts, whatever, it was covered. Your tax dollars at work.
Are they giving you a salary as well?
Yeah, when I got back, I would file the report, and usually within a week, I would meet my handler and be given my pay in cash, of course, Bank of America, always in a Bank of America envelope. I remember that. I could easily, very easily, George, and again, my family doesn't even know this, but they would usually give me anywhere from $800 to $2,000 for expenses, depending on where I was going. When I got back and filed the reports, it was not unusual for a 4 or 5 day assignment to get $2,400.
Back to this guy, Matt Hale. You said that he's doing 40 years. That's not based on information you gave them, though, is it?
I don't know that I would if I could, George, but I can't answer that because I don't know how deep they went into that investigation. I know he was convicted for attempting to hire another federal informant to hire to kill a federal judge. That was what his indictment and conviction was on. Now, I don't know if my time with him played into that. I don't know what my information that I passed along, I don't know if that was a factor. I'd like, no disrespect to Matt, not that he's listening, but I'd like to think that they took the week I spent with him into account when they were deciding what to do next. I'd hate to think I spent a week there for absolutely nothing.
But you said when you got back and you had to wonder, well, gosh, are they really after the right guy? Because he didn't seem all that much of a bad guy. But you were mistaken. I mean,
George,
he's threatening to kill a federal judge or plotting to kill a federal judge.
the only, oh Lord, I'll have to tread lightly here again. The only thing that convicted him was the testimony of another federal informant doing the same thing that I was doing. It was this one person's word against Matt Hale's word. I guess your average jury, George, is going to take anyone's word over Matt Hale's word because of the public image that he had. I'm not saying that I don't think he was guilty. I'm saying that I do wish there had been more evidence before convicting somebody for a 40 to life sentence.
All right. Let's talk about your second assignment for the FBI. And is this also, this is something in Idaho involving the Aryan Nations. Is that a suggestion you made? Hey, send me up to Idaho and I'll get in on, with these guys?
No, I actually was a little intimidated at the time. Aryan Nations was the largest group and had the reputation for being a very violent organization. As a matter of fact, they were ultimately shut down by a civil lawsuit where their properties were seized because they shot at people driving past their property with assault rifles. I knew their reputation. I was actually running a radio station down in Shelby, North Carolina at the time. I was a GM and on air. But I was called on a Wednesday by my handler in Norfolk who said, you need to be in Idaho Friday night. And I said, well, thanks for the notice, But the money was sent. I arranged the travel. I flew out Friday morning, arrived on Friday evening. Nobody out there knew me. I had called ahead and talked to the folks at the Aryan Nations. They actually had an office. Georgia, they had a multi-acre compound. I mean, it was a huge setup out there, barracks and everything. I mean, it essentially was its own little nation inside of this fence. So I called and told them who I was and a little bit of my background and that I was a journalist. And they welcomed me with open arms. I got there. I met a person named Pastor Richard Butler, who was the head of the organization and the founder of the organization. Richard at the time had to be 80, had to be. He was a World War II veteran. Believe it or not, a nice guy. It was like talking to somebody's grandfather until you got into politics. That's when it changed a little. But within 10 minutes, I had been offered the Virginia state leadership seat for the Aryan Nations. If you want to hear a kind of hair-raising story there for a couple of minutes, I've got one. I don't think I shared with you, George, but
Let's hear it.
my second assignment out, and as you can imagine, doing this, you're already nervous when you walk in the door somewhere. You're scared to death. And for 11 years, I was always nervous. They always told me if you ever stop being nervous, you're in trouble. I get out there about 3 hours into the event this Saturday. There's a guard post up at the front gate, of course, and they are armed. These people are armed, George. They were in uniform, and they were carrying weapons. About 3 hours in, someone realized that the guest list with everybody's name and contact information and license plate numbers, the guest list was missing. This is the information that I was sent to get, of course. Only I did not have what they were looking for, but I did have my notes in my pocket that I had been making. When I first started, I couldn't do this all in my head. I had to jot things down and hide them in my pockets and socks and everything. Well, they lined us all up to search us all inside one of the barracks. And about, of course, had they searched me, they would have found license plates written down and descriptions of people and people's names and where they're from and what I thought of them. About three people in front of me, before they got to me, George, a guy runs in and says, "We found the list."
Oh, boy.
And George, I have never in my life felt the way I felt that night.
Well, what would have happened to you?
You know, Aryan Nations, as I said, had a reputation. People, members have gone missing. I mean, that's documented fact. Members have gone missing. Members have been beaten nearly to death. When you leave these organizations, if you don't leave on good terms, you're not exactly in you know, the insurance company's safe hands. You're not in good hands here if you upset these people. Aryan Nations was a very militant organization, and was not afraid to express themselves. And I honestly, George, I shudder to think what might have happened that night. I really do.
Did these organizations, something like that, have their own intelligence setups where they will check out the background of anybody who shows up?
Yes, Aryan Nations was good for that. They were extremely organized. The management, I guess, for lack of a better term, of Aryan Nations probably had a combined 100 years experience in the movement. A lot of former military guys, a guy named Jimbo, as a matter of fact, that was kind of like the head of their security. He was a retired Marine. He was one of those guys you knew not to upset, you know. But Aryan Nations was good for intel. The National Socialist Movement was very good for intel because that was my department. Ironic. I was in charge of the party's intel. Well, I call it the party, the organization's intel. I was in charge of their internal affairs, and I was also turning information over to the Department of Justice. I guess that's irony at its finest. But David Duke's organization was pretty famous for its intel. They knew who you were before you walked in the door.
There's a photo, I think, of you that I haven't seen it, but you told me about it, of you with David Duke on the day that he announced the creation of a different organization. I think it's called No Fear, or did you, in fact, file reports about David Duke, provide information to the FBI about him?
I did. I was sent to Philadelphia. I knew David from being a journalist. David had been on my radio show a couple of times, and people cringe when I say this, but you've got to get to know the people, these people individually. I like David Duke. David is, as a person, David is a nice guy, and I never, in all my time around David, I never heard David say anything disrespectful or hateful about anybody. Which was kind of shocking to me because I knew what he was supposed to be. I was sent to Philadelphia, I want to say in 2000, Georgia, 11 years, it all runs together. But David was founding an organization called No Fear, which they had to change to Euro, European American Rights Organization. The No Fear clothing company actually sued David Duke to stop him from using the name. But it was David's answer to the NAACP. It was going to be a white rights organization. I'll never forget. It was at a very swanky hotel. It was $75 a plate dinner, and I remember thinking, "How in the world?" Because you know, the only people I knew were Klan people at that point, George. How in the world are the Klan people going to afford $75 a plate? You know, but there were probably 400 people at that gathering, and yeah, I stood right next to David Duke while the CNN cameras. CNN and C-SPAN actually were there that night while they were both running. And somewhere out there is tons of video footage of me and David Duke in Philadelphia.
Did the information that you provided, and we'll get into the mechanics of that in a minute, but did it help put any people away?
They never told us precisely what they used our information for, but I could name five or six individuals that I filed reports on over the years that are currently serving very long prison sentences. You know, mathematically speaking, I can only assume.
Do they know about you, your former colleagues in this organization? Is this revelation tonight coming as a surprise to them, or they suspected it already?
This is the absolute first time ever. I'm watching my Facebook right now. My best friend in the entire world is on Facebook and is currently incredibly shocked by what I'm saying. My mother and father were aware because I felt like it was necessary to tell them where their only son was going all these times. Aside from my mom and dad and well, you, I think this is a first, George.
I'm just wondering. Yeah, I can imagine there's a range of reactions, including, "Hey, this guy needs to pay for this." We'll get into that because you're more worried about the FBI than you are worried about the white supremacists and white nationalists, and I want to get into explaining that when we come back. John Cougar Mellencamp, this is his first song where he dropped the cougar part back from 1983. Crumbling Down is the song. We'll be back with Brian Holland and more of his big reveal right after this on Coast to Coast. We just heard our guest Brian Holland reveal for the first time that the 11 years that he spent inside white nationalist organizations, he was actually working for the FBI, giving them reports about these organizations and individuals within them, their activities, their goals, and all sorts of other things. When we come back, we'll get Brian's idea on what kind of danger he might be in now. He told me confidentially he's more worried about the FBI and how they're going to react than he is about some of his former colleagues in those organizations. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Brian, tell me about sort of the mechanics of how it worked with the FBI. You would come back and write reports about different people and organizations that you encountered. Did you meet with these guys face to face, or was that considered like a risk?
Oh no, I met. Generally meeting at the events, the bigger folks in the movement, you know, the upper echelons of the movement, I would generally meet with the night before the event. I was always in town at least 2 days early, being an upper guy myself, I guess. I was always in town early when the other bigger folks got into town. We'd always get together for private meetings. I went to a lot of these guys' houses. I got to know, I got to know the people behind the image. Some of the people fit the image perfectly. Some of these guys are all around nice guys with just very bad viewpoints, if that makes sense to anybody, George. But, you know, I guess even the worst people in the world have moments when they're just good, friendly people.
You've shared with me different emails, the kinds of things that went back and forth between you and the FBI, the Department of Justice. Did you have one handler through all this time, or were there more?
I had one handler for probably 9 years. The gentleman I met that day that I went to lunch with Charlie, his name was Greg. Out of respect for Greg, I'm not going to give his last name, but it is, I imagine, public record. If you call the office and ask for Greg, you'll probably get him. But I had him for years. He brought me in, with the exception of, I guess, 7 or 8 months out of that 9 years when he was on assignment. He went overseas on occasion. He was actually a terrorism expert and an explosives expert. So he would occasionally go overseas to handle classes or investigations or things, and I'd be passed along to someone else, which generally meant I was going to have a stretch of time when nothing happened, because the folks I got passed on to just either weren't concerned with what I was doing or had no idea how to handle what I was doing. But when Greg got promoted and sent to Washington, D.C., I went through a string of other handlers, and that's where it started falling apart.
Before we get to that, you're talking about him going overseas. You were also heading overseas for an assignment, an idea that you had. Tell me about that.
We our big idea was we knew where the money was coming from. Greg and I, first of all, I have to say, because he may very well be listening. Everybody in this market knows that I'm doing this tonight. But Greg and I became more friends than we did coworkers. I think the world of Greg, and I like to think that he feels the same way. Super nice guy, good at his job, very loyal, good family guy. But we finally decided we need to figure out where this money is coming from, and maybe that can shut down a lot of things if we can pinpoint this. The sample I sent you was a, and I didn't know how big of a trip this was. I had never thought about it, but we were actually, and I say we because Greg would have had to have gone with me. That's the agreement with the foreign countries. When you do this type of work, you have to have their permission, and someone has to come with you. But we would have started in London, made our way over to Germany. I believe there was a little stopover down in Italy, and we ultimately would have been on a train ride for, George, I think it's about an 8-month train ride, I guess, to Vladivostok in the former Soviet Union. This is a big, expensive trip. We would have met the powers that be in the European neo-Nazi movement, and it would have been extremely beneficial to the Department of Justice gaining intelligence that they didn't have on how the money was coming over. Unfortunately, somewhere in Washington, D.C., an accountant decided that that intelligence was not worth the expense of the trip. And that operation was shut down by someone who sits in front of a calculator all day.
So are there neo-Nazis in Russia?
Oh, yes. Big, big. Like I said earlier, 8, 10,000, 12,000. I've seen as high as 15,000 people at these rallies. Yes.
Well, I can tell you, I've been to Vladivostok. You didn't miss anything by not going there, man. It's a real garden spot.
Not a big tourist place, George.
No, no. So the FBI is not going to acknowledge that you work for them, though, are they?
No, certainly not. I spoke with my attorney who said, do you have possession of the reports? I said, yeah, I do. He said, well, then they're yours. Because the FBI is not going to go on the news and say, hey, we paid this guy for 11 years and he's got property that belongs to us. I'm not worried about that. I've got, you've seen some samples. You know, I've got probably 1,500 reports from over the years, George. I've got all kinds of stuff, you know, that I wrote, and I guess legally speaking, they're my property. A few are going into my book. I forgot about my book, George. A few are going into my book, which is called Riding the Fence. I named it Riding the Fence because, you know, a lot of people sit on the fence to make a decision. Oh, it's called Living the Fence. I'm sorry. But a lot of people sit on the fence to make a decision. George, I had to live the darn thing for 11 years. But the book, by the way, do you mind if I do my website?
No, go ahead.
Oh,
go ahead.
Thank you. I'd forgotten completely about it. The book is available on my website, which is face2facewithbrianholland.com. I'd appreciate you purchasing the book because as I sit here talking to George, it hits me how many people are hearing this.
Well, I mean, you're not employable as a broadcaster anymore,
no,
right?
No, folks. George, thank you. No, since I was cut by the department, I have basically had zero income. I went from making literally, there were months, George, I did $7,000 or $8,000 a month doing this. And tax-free, of course. Because oddly, they won't give you a W-2. But yeah, I went from that to absolutely nothing with no warning. I was one of the top three neo-Nazis in North America. I didn't anticipate this ending anytime soon, you know. That's another story in itself, I guess.
Well, let's hear that. How did it end?
I filed a report on a Florida trip. So by the way, folks, buy the book, please. My family is starving to death here. Filed a report on a Florida trip that was questioned by my new handler, which I like to call the handler of the week. I answered the questions. George, what a lot of people don't realize with this work is I randomly was given polygraph tests that I had to pass over 11 years with questions like, are your reports factual? Are they accurate? Have you ever withheld information? Have you ever given us improper information? Well, George, I passed these things for 11 years. Obviously, if I weren't passing them, they wouldn't have kept paying me, I would imagine, and certainly wouldn't have been sending me to the places they had sent me. But this one new handler questioned a report. I answered their concerns. I gave receipts. I did everything that I was taught to do. I was called to a hotel in Chesapeake, Virginia one day, which is right outside of Norfolk, where my handler and two of my former handlers were there, and a person I had never met before who I discovered was one of the SACs, which is Special Agent in Charge of the Norfolk FBI office. I don't mind giving his name because I can't call him what I usually call him, so I'll give his name. His name is Ed Buckley. We sat and talked for about 2 minutes. Ed lit a cigar that had to be about 8 feet around, lit a cigar, stuck it in his mouth, stuck his hand out and said, son, you've done a great service to your country. Now you don't exist. And with the with the shake of a bureaucratic hand, George, the third highest ranking neo-Nazi in the country was put out to pasture after 11 years of risking my life.
Well, they had to know, too, that if it ever got out, that them cutting you loose, your life would be in danger.
Very much. I have contacted Ed. Actually, when I started writing the book, which was a little bit before you and I had initial contact, I called Ed out of professional respect and said, Ed, can I write this book? Ed told me point blank, I don't want to talk to you, I don't want anything to do with you, and I frankly don't care what you do, and hung up on me. And I sat there kind of dumbfounded. I mean, I extended my hand to ask, basically ask permission to tell my own story, George. And that's the treatment I got, which, by the way, I called Ed about 2 weeks ago to ask him again if he was okay with this. Because, you know, you don't want to upset the FBI, George, you know?
Yeah.
And I got the same treatment. Stop calling here. We don't know who you are. I don't want to hear from you. Click. And I thought, you know, 11 years, my life was on the line. My family was in danger. And I'm getting hung up on by a bureaucrat who has nothing better to do.
Well, where does it stand now in terms of danger issues? Are you concerned about your former colleagues in those organizations coming after you? Are you concerned what the FBI might do for you telling this story?
I'm more concerned with the FBI than I am with my former colleagues. I can say, as far as my former colleagues go, I can probably pick out 10 people in the country that are stupid enough to make an attempt to do anything with this. Of course, I may be wrong. You know, I mean, common sense will tell you at this point, I know the size of your audience. Yeah, I used to compete with you guys, as a matter of fact. I was on another network opposite you. Well, I didn't really compete. I was just on at the same time. But somewhere out there, there is someone listening that belongs to this movement and is thinking, well, we need to do something about this. And I know that. And that's why I think the only person in the world that knows where I'm doing this interview from tonight is your producer, Gina. And I trust Gina. I'm assuming I'm safe with her. So.
Yes, you are. She's a trustworthy young lady.
I like Gina. So, yeah, I'm concerned with the few. You know, I mentioned earlier there are lone wolves out there that do the rogue thing and go out and do what they want to do, thinking that it's going to make them a superstar in the movement. You know, there are those people, and that does concern me. But I'm honestly, I'm going to channel Alex Jones here, but I'm more concerned with the Department of Justice than I am with the white supremacist movement.
What could they do?
Well,
put you away.
Yeah, they could. They could do a lot, George. I worked with them for 11 years. I saw and learned things that, as I said earlier, I thought was only in the movies. I had no idea. They literally. Anybody they want to know, they know where you are 24 hours a day, every second of the day. They've got ultimately control over every aspect of life, your ID, your driving, your taxes, your everything, George. These people, this administration in particular, has put the tentacles out of the central government into every aspect of everyday life. I mean, we're talking about an FBI that even had me at one point investigating PETA, the animal rights group.
Tell me that story.
PETA at one point, and they may still be, they were considered domestic terrorists. I was actually called one day, and my handler at the time said, "Do you think you'd fit in at PETA?" And I laughed hysterically. I said, "Dude, I'm a conservative Republican that belongs to Nazi organizations. I mean, do you think I'm going to fit in at PETA?" You know. But I got talked into it and got paid. God bless them.
What did you find out about PETA?
That they drink Sam Adams beer at the meetings, and that I don't like mushrooms. That's about the extent of what I learned. I stuffed envelopes. I watched some videos. I talked to some people about some stories they had about pets and their family. And I attended 7 or 8 meetings, George, and nowhere did I see the necessity to spend tax dollars on this organization.
You know, there must be many others like you in these white organizations. They have to know that they're infiltrated, that there's a pretty good chance of other moles inside.
Yeah, they do. Go ahead. I'm sorry, George.
No, go ahead. I just get your feelings on that.
I was going to say the FBI joke was that 4 out of 5 people that you talk to at these meetings are doing the same thing you're doing. I mean, they were very open about that, and I knew that. And I honestly got to the point where I could pick these people out. To my knowledge, and of course they'll never correct me if I'm wrong, but George, to my knowledge, I believe I was the deepest and most long-serving intel source within the white supremacist movement in the history of the investigation. We're talking 11 years here, going all the way to the top. But I got to the point where I could pretty much tell the new sources that were coming to the meetings, because they're scribbling notes. You know, they're wearing something that I've worn before, you know, like a listening device or a recording device. I learned to spot these things. And I would always tell my handler, you need to let whoever is responsible for this guy know that you can pick him out in a crowd. And it worried me because you can get hurt. But they do. They're very aware that they are infiltrated. They are extremely aware, which is, part of the push to go for the new image, part of the push to go for the political look, the political party image. They're very aware. And, they are, the intel within these organizations has stepped up, which is, funny as it seems, what I did for the National Socialist Movement. Part of my job was internal affairs to root out the people that were threats to the organization.
You were providing information or at least some kind of assistance to another organization called the Southern Poverty Law Center. Tell me about them and what you did with them.
I left the FBI, the Bureau, for a little while I was managing a radio station in Elizabeth City, North Carolina. I got frustrated over I don't even remember what it was, but I think my handler, Greg, was out of town at the time, and I usually got really irritated when he was out of town. So I walked away, and I think for a period of a couple of years, actually, I knew who the Southern Poverty Law Center was from my work with the Bureau. I contacted them, kind of clumsily fumbled around, trying to ask nicely if they had an intel division, which officially they don't. They have what's called Klan Watch, which is ostensibly to educate law enforcement officers about hate crimes and things. But I won't say his full name, but his name is Joe. Joe runs the operation down there. He's a former police officer, super nice guy. Got Joe on the phone. Joe said, "Who's your handler?" I told him. I gave him Greg's name, and he said, "Yeah, I know Greg." And with that verification right there, I literally was put on a retainer. I got a check the first of every month to be on staff for them, well, staff quote unquote. And they also sent me on intel gathering trips. I did, I'd probably say 8 or 10 assignments for the SPLC, the Southern Poverty Law Center. Of course, anybody that's familiar with Morris Dees, who is the head of the law center, Morris is actually the one that sued Aryan Nations and got them shut down. I think he won a $6 million settlement from Aryan Nations.
Ultimately, you had a very distinct break with the FBI. It wasn't just, thanks, you're done. You had an offer of additional information that you came across while working on a news story that you offered to the federal government, and they didn't want anything to do with it. Tell me that.
I ran across locally in the Norfolk, Virginia area. I ran across a drug ring and a firearms distribution ring. What bothered me the most about it, George, was that it was targeting teenagers. I'm very anti-drug, extremely anti-drug, and it was targeting teenagers in the Norfolk and Virginia Beach area. I stumbled across it accidentally. I actually called Greg, my old handler. I've still got his phone number, still keep in touch with him. I said, "Greg, I've got information. Do I have to run it through your office?" He said, "Nope, we don't care what you do." Which is about as nice a contact as I've had with the Bureau since then. But I went to the federal building in Norfolk, Virginia, sat down with the DEA at first, the Drug Enforcement Administration, sat down with them, gave them all the details. They said, they asked me who my handler was, had been at the FBI. I told him, and he, of course, said, "Oh yeah, we know him." The agent that I spoke with said, "Would you mind working the case?" I said, "You know what? I don't know how to do anything else at this point. I'd love to work the case." He said, "Now, as far as your firearms go, go downstairs 2 floors and stop at the ATF." I said, "Well, what am I going to do at the ATF?" He said, "Well, we can't do anything with the firearms, but we're not going to stop you from working with two agencies at once," which was unusual because, George, the FBI, they don't allow you to work with anybody else. You're their source, and that's it. Well, I stopped at the ATF, talked with a couple of
Hey,
nice agents.
Brian, I'm sorry. I'm going to have to interrupt it. That music tells us we're going to a break. We'll continue this conversation on the other side and then open up the phone lines. I got a feeling we got a lot of folks who want to talk to you. And I look forward to hearing what some of these calls are going to be. Triumph, lay it on the line back from back in 1979, taking us into the break on Coast to Coast AM.